Sure. I did an undergraduate degree at Ohio State University, finishing up after World War II, and I did a PhD in economics at MIT, and taught at Rice University in Houston, Texas during the 1950s. Came to Treasury mid-1963 as a consultant, and have been here ever since.
Okay. When you went to the Treasury then, Dylan was Secretary of the Treasury, and Rosa was under him.
Right.
The key economic decisions would have all been passed through Rosa. He was the key person, economic consultant beyond Dylan.
I think it's essentially accurate, although Dylan's deputy, Joe Fowler, later secretary in his own right, you know, was an active participant in a lot of the decisions, but general recognition that people deferred to Rosa in, to some degree, in both domestic and international financial areas.
Did you have contact with Rosa?
Yes.
What position did you come in as?
I came in as a consultant. Actually, I had written an article in Fortune magazine on sort of outer defenses of the dollar, and I guess it came to Rosa's attention and was not unduly critical and sort of piqued his interest. And they were doing a lot of hiring and at the time, and so I was approached and was glad to take a year's leave, I thought, at the time, and so came up here. And,
so your specialty,
as I said before.
Your specialty was international then?
That's correct.
And the mechanisms, the outer defenses that had that Rosa put in place, those were pretty much all in place by the time you got there. The swap network was set up in 60.
They did some token forward market operations, didn't really go much beyond the token area.
The dollar really wasn't under it, didn't come under attack then for several years, essentially until 66.
Yeah, quite right. And you know, really didn't come under attack until the early 70s, although ample signs were apparent, you know, in the late 1960s that trouble might well lie ahead. And we had a succession of ad hoc balance of payments programs beginning somewhere there in the 60s, you know, and sort of annual reinstallments and changing programs, sometimes in cooperation with the Commerce Department. So there was, you know, an effort to avoid the wrenching adjustment that later did take place when we, I don't know how you want to describe it, left the Bretton Woods Agreement or closed the gold window or a series of actions taken in mid-1971, as I recall.
I'm curious.
Right.
There was a standard view of the balance of payments problem at the time where economists viewed it as structural. Americans had too many defense commitments abroad. American corporations were investing too much abroad, but those were viewed as problems that could be dealt with special programs. We had a balance of payments surplus on the current account and merchandise, a strong positive balance of payments on trade accounts. So people basically thought the dollar was healthy apart from these other kind of problems. Did you essentially accept that view at that time? It's kind of what, you know, I assume was this a conventional view of the problem?
Well, I don't think quite that view was held at Treasury. recall, under previous Republican administration, had reacted, some might say overreacted, to signs, you know, that the dollar was going to have to undergo some adjustments. And at least at Treasury, there was sufficient continuing concern over the balance of payments deficit to before the special programs were introduced in the Vietnam era, so-called Operation Twist, an effort to sort of separate as best one could the internal and external objectives. Of course, opinions differ. I think the verdict on Operation Twist is essentially negative now, and maybe fortuitous that the CD was being developed and euro dollar markets were beginning to grow, and so it probably was easier then to keep short-term rates up as we sought to do in the interest of some sort of short-term balance of payments equilibrium. It was also a period when there really was not the consensus that there might be now on sort of a market-oriented definition of a payments deficit. Because we had, as I recall, headed by now deceased John Reynolds, quite a study internally in the government as to what the appropriate definition of a balance of payments deficit was. And Commerce, Walter Lader, and others favored, I forget what they call liquidity balance, and there was a basic balance, which might be the offset on doing current account surplus and voluntary long-term capital outflows.
Right.
We had a lot of heavy borrowing by foreigners in this market, and Rose and Volcker put in the interest equalization tax. This was an era when there was some modicum of agreement between CEA and Treasury that we ought to try to pursue sort of an active growth-oriented policy at home without leading, you know, to some deterioration of the external payments position. It all seems a long time ago, and our sensitivity to the issues must have appeared to be absurdly high, although in retrospect, I don't think the long-term diagnosis was all that wrong. Accentuated and accelerated by Vietnam, it did result in departing from the gold standard in the era of floating in the 70s and difficulties which some would argue have reached an even larger scale at the present time.
Okay, you mentioned
the non-Treasury diagnosis.
Yeah, you mentioned a number of things I'd like to ask you about.
Really?
Let me go back to Operation Twist. That, of course, was instituted before you came to the Treasury. Did you have any sense of...
Well, it was talked about. Yeah, I guess it was hard to separate rhetoric from action in that whole area, I think.
The reason I ask is...
Really?
Is that when I've gone back and I've talked to people who were, say, at the New York... They viewed it primarily as a way of putting off the Council of Economic Advisors, especially Tobin,
right,
giving themselves some flexibility to raise short-term rates. The council caring almost exclusively about the long-term rate. But Rosa himself was interventionist by nature, so he probably took this very seriously. Do you think, and really thought it would have a significant effect, given one knows about him coming out of the New York Fed and that interventionist tradition?
Right, sort of a sophisticated, cautious interventionism, I would say, but I wouldn't quarrel with the idea that he certainly was more interventionist than, let's say, a series of predecessors in the 1950s. Here at Treasury and probably also elsewhere in the system at the time, Volcker and Rosa, of course Rosa was the first and preeminent person at the time, they're viewed as innovators.
What was the reference to, what did you have in mind about prior intervention?
Bills only in the monetary policy area, and Rosa would be more inclined, you know, pioneered in advance refundings and whole series of innovations in the debt management and both domestic and international financial areas, possibly more form than substance, but more of a concerted effort to try to never to obstruct or try to divert market forces, but to shape them, you know, in a promising direction. How much of that, you know, was rhetoric and how much in retrospect appears, you know, to have been form and substance, I'm really not sure.
Okay, let me ask you about your comment. You said the CEA and the Treasury jointly believed that they could stimulate economic growth, and there was
right.
a corresponding unwillingness to sacrifice domestic objectives.
Sure, which were strongly argued for at the council, and, you know, by and large, very strongly by most of the professional economic community.
How did Ellen and Rosa balance off the two conflicts, domestic versus international? When you go back and you look at this period, it does seem as though there's some willingness to tolerate interest rate increases in response to losses. On the other hand, you have the interest equalization tax, which is a highly interventionist measure designed to circumvent classical
procedures. Think that's a value judgment of yours. It was an expedient sort of step at the time to try to separate the domestic and international interest rate structures in a key area. Sure, it was interventionist and in some sense of the term, but I always thought of it as more a reaction to a problem at the time, a palliative, more than anything fundamental or lasting in its effect. It was one in a series of sort of stratagems to try to reconcile external and internal balance.
Okay, so let me ask...
Neither Dillon nor Rosa was interventionist, and, you know, anything more than the sense of a non-intervention stream of policy making which had gone before, and the extent to which I always thought Dillon and Rosa were pretty artful, and but they also probably functioned in an atmosphere which allowed them either to achieve these objectives or to seem to, and the line between the two is very difficult to draw.
Okay, well, let me ask the question slightly differently. What I'm trying...
Their views, it seems to me, have worn as well or better than Tobin's.
Yes.
Who in this area would probably have imposed a transactions tax.
Yes, that still comes.
Yeah, the Czechs are using one now, I think. Let's hope it works.
Yeah. Well, I suspect they'll find the same.
It might work better there than it would here. I'll give them that much.
Wasn't the response to the interest equalization tax the Eurodollar market and the move offshore? So it's hard to believe in an economy like Czechoslovakia, which is right in the middle of Europe, that that they can make it stick.
The Eurodollar market, you know, clearly predated the interest equalization tax, but surely did give it a great stimulus.
Well, I guess the Russians started the Eurodollar market, and then
they're given the credit, whether they deserve it or not. I guess so. Rodney Bank, as I recall.
Yeah. Let me ask you, in thinking about this period, should we have the Council and the Treasury as working fairly closely together, or should one think of them often at loggerheads, competing?
Never at loggerheads, adversarial but respectful, cooperative in most areas.
But the Treasury was more sensitive, I guess, because of its operational reasons and the personalities. Right. I mean, it was definitely more sensitive to the international situation.
Surely.
Because of the importance attached to the international situation and the Treasury's operational responsibility generally deferred to the Treasury on policy issues?
On areas of international economic policy, that's my general recollection. On domestic, I'm not so sure that would as easily be established. The council was throughout most of that period, and well on into the later period, was a very strong and ably staffed. Probably it was the heyday of the council in many respects in terms of the talent drawn there and the impact that they had on economic policy. On domestic policy, I would say the council clearly had the lead, and Walter Heller had the then president's ear, and probably Dillon and Rosa were more sort of cautionary, slightly more conservative figures who were deferred to in the international area, but certainly not given any carte blanche by any means. You had some strong very respected figures at the council. It was always cooperative, as I recall, as only on the periphery of it, not having been there that long, but the Council of Economic Advisors and the Federal Reserve and Commerce Department all participated closely through the medium of a variety of ad hoc interagency groups. But Treasury did, must say, keep very close control of the process.
That was...
It could, under Dillon and Rosa and George Willis and a number of other figures who's... who had considerable influence at the time.
Sure.
Dewey Dane.
Yes, I want to talk to him, but he's so busy, he's hard to hold him. But he's still he's still around. When did the voluntary direct credit restraint and the voluntary direct investment program come up? They came up later on. Did you work on those?
No. It's my impression that they, I'm just sitting here with my feet up on the desk, 66, 67 in there throughout they started that soon. They persisted, I think, throughout the 1960s, if I recall correctly, in one guise or another.
Okay, but in any event, you didn't work on those programs.
No, they were our international people in cooperation with the Commerce Department.
Given that you were a specialist in the international, you didn't have any involvement in the tax cut. Council tried to persuade Kennedy from the beginning to go for a increase in the
debt. Right. Well, the 62, of course, had been accomplished before I arrived, mm-hmm. and I worked for Volcker when I came, and so. At some distance, but I knew what was going on in the tax area.
Okay. Before we go on to the impressions you're willing to share with Treasury and in the key economic advisors at the time, Dillon, Rosa, Volcker, Heller, you worked with some of them. Did you have contact at all with Dillon?
I was a political appointee. I knew Dillon, right.
Any impressions? He was generally kind of very competent, very capable.
Extremely so. Very... in manner patrician and somewhat withdrawn, but remarkably effective. Of course, he had a very distinguished career at the State Department before he came over to Treasury. Had a special relationship with the Kennedys, and
I guess they ran in common social circles.
Yeah, I believe that's correct. And Dylan was a remarkably efficient administrator. I can remember to this day, this is all, I suppose, contrived, but it was effective. He had a sort of a blue sort of buck slip that would be put on a memorandum that was sent into him, and it would ask a question or something of that nature and would be returned to the originator, and he had to respond to within 24 hours without going through regular channels and that sort of thing. I thought it was a rather ingenious way to sort of circumvent usual administrative channels and keep the whole organization on its toes, so to speak. He also, he had the practice, which I thought extremely valuable, of being an omnivorous reader of all the memoranda sent in to him. And sometimes some people would feel verged on the trivial. He was not above correcting grammar or raising what seemed to be rather minor points. But and I suppose it was either modeled after, or maybe presumptuous to say, served as a model for the president himself, who's well-known then at the time to pick up the phone, you know, and call some civil servant across town and ask him a question or something. It was, I suppose, part of the sort of the modus operandi of the new administration, and sort of, it was remarkably effective at Treasury, which is quite at the time quite a hierarchical and stodgy organization. Some vestiges still remain, although regrettably too few. But Dylan, within that structure, I thought was mystique and that sort of thing, but it was remarkably effective. Quite a gifted person by any standard, certainly. And I sometimes wondered whether as gifted probably in the foreign, you know, diplomatic and international areas, but that'd be a guess on my part.
Thanks. That's a very good description. Was he have any operational administrative responsibilities, or was he primarily an
administrator? Oh, no, Rosa was, as undersecretary, he had at least, you know, line organization for all domestic financial operations in Treasury, and in international, too, is a very powerful position, undersecretary for monetary affairs.
So he'd be heavily involved in making decisions about
problems, yes,
deciding maturities and that kind of thing.
Surely, okay. Yes.
Okay, well, that makes sense.
It was actually on his watch that indexing began in the U.S. government, which is a sort of an insider's tale. And
indexing, I wasn't aware. This is the indexing's a special topic of mine.
Oh, really? I'll give you a name to.
I've written on it.
Oh, interesting. I'll give you a name to. You can call him direct. A fellow named Duane Saunders, who served here in the debt management area for a very long period of time. He was here. Predated Rosa, certainly. He was here in the early 1960s and can tell you in a charming anecdotal fashion that I can't reproduce as to just how indexing, so to speak, slipped by or sneaked by Rosa. It was really, I think, an administrative breakdown in the system that indexing ever started. Of course, obviously, it would soon have started thereafter, after the inflationary pressures intensified.
Precisely, what do you mean by indexing? What was indexed? How was it indexed?
I think it started with federal retirement. But forgive me, I'm not certain on that. But I think that was, as Saunders tells it, the indexing precedent in terms of the federal budget.
Mm-hmm.
And memory fails me, as it so often does these days, as to in just what obscure and largely technical way it first escaped Rosa's attention, and then it was impossible to reverse it when the oversight was discovered.
Why would he have been opposed to indexing.
Visceral.
Admitting defeat on inflation.
Well, general beliefs that indexing, that was just taken as axiomatic at the time, although Treasury now is, considering the possibility of issuing index bonds. But for people like Dylan, Rosa, and Volcker, I think would still have grave doubts as to the desirability of indexing debt, which is another issue entirely, I recognize. But indeed, is it not the case that it is the indexing and other things in the entitlement area which make the current budgetary situation, if not impossible, at least terribly difficult? Maybe it's a target of opportunity, too, because, indexing minus beta or epsilon or something over time, but that's just a measure of how difficult the problem has become.
I'd love to talk to you about indexing, sure. But let's go back to the 60s because I don't want to get off into one of my
spots. Okay.
What about Volcker? You worked with him.
Right.
Very hardworking, very smart, very capable, very
very disorganized, organized in that disorganized fashion. Used to have an inbox that would periodically get up to 2 feet or so. Sort of creative delay, never making a decision until he felt he absolutely had to. Artful beyond belief in dealing with the Council of Economic Advisors. Rose's very valuable and valued assistant at the time. Volcker could approach and deal with his CEA colleagues in a way that Rosa might find a little more difficult. Rosa's a little more distant personality, and Rosa would find it, difficult to... And then he was a contemporary, I suppose, a lot of the heavy hitters at CEA, and they might have regarded him, as gifted but lacking sort of the academic cachet, and Volcker would just lope around like a Great Dane, and accomplish a lot more than Rosa could.
Rosa wasn't an easily approachable,
no.
Congenial person. I just assumed he was.
He was a very nice person, but very sophisticated and just an extremely nice person. But I would not say particularly approachable.
You wouldn't just
person.
You wouldn't just drop into his office to chat.
No. A different personality type altogether than Volcker.
But you might do that with Volcker.
I can remember Dave Meiselman, who was here when I came. Meiselman and Volcker used to probably sit around for hours at night talking about Sidney Homer on interest rates or Meiselman's work. Now, Volcker was given to long conversations. And
that's probably why he ended up as Fed chairman.
Possibly so.
Volcker worked with the council on triad meetings, doing projections, that kind of staff work preparatory to whatever the quadriad meetings they had.
Mm-hmm. Right. I wouldn't make too much of the quadriad. That's a sort of a pet peeve of mine. It never amounted to very much. Occasionally, I'd have to go back and search the files or something. Bill Martin over at the Fed for most of that time, and they valued their distance and independence, although they didn't have the abilities, not the political leverage that they do at the present time. I remember during 1965 it must have been, I think McChesney Martin was finally, we're into Johnson now, finally pulled down to the ranch, and allowed to raise the discount rate or something. I think Volcker had been trying to persuade Martin for a period of months before, you know. So it was not that the quadriad really functioned. It was more for appearance than anything else. Council was hot on, you know, beginning of the year, have the CEA forecast and call the Fed in and make sure that what they did was consistent with the economic tableau, but it never worked like that. It only worked like that once. We're running ahead, and that was in 1968, and the results were, if not catastrophic, far from ideal.
Yeah.
You know, the quadriad's more, it was a gleam in the council's eye rather than anything more.
Mm-hmm. My understanding of the quadriad, that it was primarily served as a forum where the economic advisors of the president could get the president together with the head of the Fed,
right,
and exercise that kind of moral suasion that,
right,
comes with, that is, if the head of the Fed meets with head of the OMB and head of the council, or even head of the Treasury, you know,
sure,
you're one among equals. But if you bring the president, it's additional way of bringing pressure on the Fed.
Well, I suppose that's true. That's right. And Volcker knew it so well that he wouldn't return phone calls from the Reagan White House. So, sure, there's something in there. And I can remember, I guess it must have been in 1965, we had a series of, to me, the identifying, and this is, you know, sort of pedantic or bureaucratic, the identifying characteristic of an operating quadriad would be if you had staff-level participation.
Yeah, apparently that was tried in the late 60s.
65, we tried it, and again, and forced to try it in 68. But in between those interludes, I'm trusting to memory, I think, and I don't even know of the instances when they did meet. I think it was a principals meeting, you know. There was,
yeah,
was, as you quite properly put it, exercise and moral suasion.
Tell me about economic input from economic analysis was organized for Treasury as opposed to the Dillon Treasury. Dillon had a background, obviously, in financial markets, but
right,
Fowler's background was as a lawyer. He
right,
was a lawyer for TVA, and then he had a private practice.
Right, and at a stint, the post-Korea War Production Board and that sort of thing.
Right, and his real advantages were in King the Hill and
right,
getting programs through
yes,
Congress, organizing support, that kind of thing. So
correct,
he didn't come with a background in financial markets or economics.
Correct.
And Joe Barr had studied some economics, but you know, he himself, he'd been in Congress and
sure,
you know, private business.
Right.
So how was economic analysis funneled up to the top in the Fowler Treasury as opposed to the Dillon?
Well, a lot easier probably than under Dillon and Rosa. Rosa, you know, would let stuff go to Dillon if he thought he should and otherwise wouldn't. Joe Barr was not that kind of person by temperament or, for that matter, ability, although an absolutely first-rate guy and someone with whom you should talk. But Fowler and Barr were more hands-on managers, so in the congressional relations mode and much more approachable and recognized, if you will, their own sort of shortcomings, or certainly they didn't have the expertise of Dillon or Rosa, but and then they, I, you know, without a table of organization, I can't even remember. Let's see, Volcker was in and out, and then back up to Chase, and I guess you have Fred Deming coming in somewhere in there to.
Deming came in early 65.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And Volcker left in the fall of 65.
Yeah, right. So Deming was the sort of the key, the replacement figure for, I guess, parts of Rosa and Volker. Rosa seemed to me, I'm not just sure when they, you know, moved out, but by and large, there was a obvious and perceptible change when Johnson took over.
In the Johnson administration, apart from tax matters, the council was pretty dominant on economic, domestic economic issues, and then the
certainly more so than they had been earlier in the 60s, and if I recall correctly, well, let's see, this first Gardner Ackley, and then Art Oken, I guess, right. Later in the period.
Right, Oken came in, I suppose, January 68.
Uh-huh, and of course they were each in their own way, extremely gifted and capable, and probably to some degree, probably overmatched Treasury to a degree which had not been characteristic of the early part of the 60s.
In terms of forcefulness of personality, was there a difference between Heller, Ackley, and Oakland, or were they all extremely capable?
I think they certainly were all extremely capable, no question about it. And Treasury had no Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy until, I think, Murray Weidenbaum was first in after the 1968 election. He comes in maybe 69, I'm not sure. And Treasury was a little short in that area at the time. And, of course, it was much more an intensely political episode, and the, maybe tragedy would be too strong. The irony was that an extremely gifted Council of Economic Advisors, some might say, and would apply perhaps with greater force to Treasury, were kind of complicitous in the very unfortunate, you know, fiscal and ultimately monetary outcome by the end of the decade.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the questions in this period, 65, 67,
right.
have to do with whether Johnson's willing to ask for a tax increase and
on again, off again, as I recall, during most of the period, and then finally came in with hindsight, we might say, too late.
Were you involved in any of that kind of discussion, or did you keep?
Well, to some degree, probably continuously throughout the period.
What about 66, with the Aldedol and Regulation Q, its extension, problems with the SNLs, that kind of thing?
Well, yeah, I remember the, and I think it was in early 66, a sort of a emergency program, since maybe we took off the investment tax credit, I'd forgotten just what else was done to, you know, we had close to a recession in early 66, most of the indicators gave a false signal, you know, and it was right next door to a recession. And
that was early 67.
Yeah.
That was early 67.
Was it?
Yeah. Okay. On the international side during this period, mission of SDRs, were you involved in that in those discussions at all?
No, I don't know. I don't recall. Not too much. I don't believe. Handled mostly, I think, in the office of the Assistant Secretary for International Affairs, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go on. The fall of 1967, the depreciation of sterling, really 1968 with the closing of the gold pool and the removal of gold cover. How much a sense of anxiety was there within the Treasury that something cataclysmic might happen? That is, if the speculators were successful in toppling the pound and then went on and the U.S. Couldn't bear the burden of keeping gold at $35 an ounce, that might create a uncontrollable demand for gold from the Treasury, the gold window might close. Was there a feeling that things might break down at that point?
Well, the existence of balance of payments programs and continuing concern testifies to some degree of concern. I would not phrase it nearly as strongly as you have. I don't myself recognize those sort of fears arising until somewhat later.
So
I could be wrong. You know, memory is pretty hazy. You might benefit from there was a Johnson historical project. I know you're in the oral tradition, but
yes, I've read the oral histories that people have submitted for this. I've read Joe Barr, for example, has I've read his oral history.
He
talks about the period.
Yeah, we did. I was in charge of the project here, and I don't know what you've read. He did some sort of overarching introduction, perhaps. We did.
Oh, no, this is for the LBJ Library.
Yeah, we did an intensive study of both international and domestic policy at the time. I probably got it around here someplace. But that's neither here nor there, except that I'm not familiar offhand with the international chapter, except I'm sure they were perhaps excessively and painfully detailed in there. I seem to remember them running on forever. And some things that might be worth your while looking at, not that they ever amounted to anything, but they're symptomatic of thinking within Treasury at the time. There were a variety of, I'd say, not very carefully thought through proposals to try to deal with some of the domestic financial market difficulties in the 60s. I just don't trust a recollection.
Okay.
Prefer to trust the written word, which, is probably
sure.
cleared at the time rather than
sure.
extemporize.
Well, if you find that.
I don't recall, but just because I don't recall doesn't mean that there wasn't considerable concern.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't think we really, of course, I would think it was to Rose and Dylan's credit that they saw the difficulties coming long before
mm-hmm.
the council did. And
mm-hmm.
those were the difficulties that culminated in 71, but it was not clear, I think, by the late 60s as to just what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Kennedy, David Kennedy comes in with Nixon. Did you continue to work?
I didn't work much in the international area.
So you weren't working for Volcker when he came back?
Well, I was, but I worked more in the domestic, but that's just a personal thing. I did not work organizationally in the international area for very long after I came to Treasury, simply because did not fall within really the area of responsibility. It just accrued to Volcker because he drew things like a magnet, but he himself in the earlier period didn't work on the international side. He just worked on the international side. He just really roamed throughout Treasury under Rose's, he just, pretty much wherever he wanted to go. When he came back in, he had pretty much domestic economic responsibility, although my good friend Charlie Walker would probably question that. I don't know just how they, I've forgotten how they did carve things up between them.
Mm-hmm. So what were you doing at that time? What were you involved with?
What period of time are we talking about now?
69-70, the 2 years that David Kennedy was Secretary of the Treasury.
Oh, well, I held the same position that I had held through the late 1960s, the same position I hold now, Director of this Office of Financial Analysis, and we had responsibilities for Treasury's GDP forecasting and monitoring of Federal Reserve policy, and then the usual variety of special tasks that you do in government.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you can tell me in a minute about monitoring the Fed, but I'd love to hear your impressions of David Kennedy. He was religious, very hardworking,
right.
But he wasn't a source of policy and ideas the way he had some pretty heavy competition at the time, George Shultz and Paul McCracken. The Treasury was not a one of the players in policy in a fundamental way under Kennedy.
So no, I think that's not the case. He was he had been at
Continental.
Yeah, and before that he had been a debt manager in the 1950s at Treasury, and it was a source of considerable disappointment and chagrin to people who had known him in his earlier stint there that he lacked a lot of the vigor and dynamism and vitality by the time he returned to Treasury in the Nixon administration. But you must recall that he came in with two very strong deputies, Charlie Walker and Volcker. And so McCracken and Shultz got a pretty good press. I thought that Treasury was probably more dominant that period than at almost any other. Increased greatly under the Nixon administration. It had atrophied, as indeed had the influence of almost all economic policy making bodies, you know, in the late stages of the Johnson administration. It was, frankly, a shambles.
That's the impression I had when I when I looked at the Nixon administration. The memos from the council, instead of going directly to the president, were going through a variety of staff people at the White House, which suggested that there wasn't nearly the kind of direct.
Very unfortunate, right.
Volcker, did you have enough contact with him to kind of understand how his thinking about the dollar evolved when he began to think that the dollar really was overvalued and when there'd have to be some kind of rearrangement of exchange rates?
Yes, he and Weidenbaum and I, you know, were in close, I suppose, daily association throughout most of the period.
And did he think through early 71 that the parity of the dollar with other major currencies could be maintained? And it was primarily the heavy gold outflows in spring of 71 that turned the situation around?
Well, no, we were doing contingency planning probably for a year or so before. And wrestling with CEA, I think Hattaker probably wanted pretty fluctuating exchange rates, I've forgotten. Volcker was, I think, quite fatalistic about the need for, let's just put it crudely, devaluation of the dollar, but just how it was to be achieved and made consonant, you know, with the responsibilities that went back to Bretton Woods. So that was, you know, not to Connally and then within the administration.
Volcker was very traditional, very conservative defender of Bretton Woods. I mean, he attached a lot of importance to fixed exchange rates and stability of exchange rates. I mean,
and then presided over two large devaluations. But he would have preferred, until it became patently impractical, he would have preferred a fixed exchange rate system. Sure.
And I mean, if he had been some kind of economic czar at the time, presumably he would have run a classical policy where when we lost gold, we'd raise the discount rate.
Oh, no.
No?
No, he never.
He wasn't.
No, he wasn't. He and Okun were not at far apart at all on economic policy whenever they were in Washington at the same time. Volcker was in the Rosa tradition, still trying to harmonize internal and external balance. Oh, no, he recognized it, and it was never, indeed, it was any his or anyone else's recognition of the patent impossibility of achieving some sort of gold standard solution, which possibly never had been achieved except maybe before World War One. You just couldn't do that. And so, obviously, when internal and external balance came into serious conflict, well, the external considerations had to be tossed aside. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a practical impossibility to operate. I suppose you'd have to ask Volcker or read his books.
I have read his book.
Yeah, well, I mean,
you know, he's pretty reserved about the things he says. I've not interviewed him.
True. Yet, you know, really. Always. That would be characteristic of him, but much more prone to experiment without Volcker. I don't know. He was the dominating figure in 71, no question about it. Everyone was, I mean, he did it all for practical purposes. I mean,
let me ask you,
Bakken and others were bystanders.
When Connally came in, let me ask you before we get on to that. Why did Kennedy leave? Nixon just wanted someone who was...
Oh, God only knows. We have to look at the Watergate tapes, I think. Nixon was, by all accounts, entranced by Connally. But for accident of history, would undoubtedly have chosen Connally to be his successor. Kennedy... I don't know. Nixon's early choices, you know, were far from ideal. I think I've forgotten Bob Mayo at OMB, Kennedy here. They'd worked closely together in the past, but that team didn't work too well. But, you know, with Ehrlichman and Haldeman in the White House, and who knows whether any could have, the strength and power was, you know, mm-hmm. in the White House. The cabinet was regarded as, sometimes almost with derision, and certainly not much responsibility granted to them, more for ceremony and show than anything else. And, of course, when Connally arrived on the scene, changed.
Now, Connally was a lawyer, had been a lawyer for oil interests in Texas. He'd been governor of Texas, so... He was not an economist. Obviously, he needed an education. So Volcker must have been the one who went around with him and educated him about what a Treasury Secretary had to know.
You'd have to ask Volcker. I think it sounds too patronizing as far as Connally is concerned. Mm-hmm. It's rather my impression that Connally came in and took hold of Treasury by the scruff of the neck and, you know,
okay, no, that's an interesting
comment. But Volcker, I don't think you could educate Connally. Any thought that you were engaged in an educational exercise, and your ass would have been booted right down the street. He's a very proud, almost imperious man, but an extremely intelligent one, and sort of intelligence in the raw, but practical intelligence. And sure, Volker and he got along well together, but
so Connolly was not the kind of person to take somebody like Volker and talk over wage and price controls with him and say, you know, what do you think about this as an economist? Will this work?
Connolly didn't have much respect for economists. He had respect for people. And if he trusted someone, felt that they were knowledgeable, and he'd take their advice. But I don't believe that he thought that that there was any sort of receptacle of received economic wisdom from which we could dip and drink deeply to our benefit. He was more pragmatic, reckless almost in his ability, willingness to experiment. And if anything, probably had to be restrained and guided maybe by someone like Volker, but educated? No, never. Connolly didn't feel he needed any education. It, in a very fundamental sense, would be contemptuous of education.
Had the businessman's attitude toward the economics profession. I'm a self-made man. I understand how the world
He was a different, much more complex character. He was a, read biographies of Johnson and Connolly. Johnson ducked the war and sort of paraded around as if he had participated in it. Connolly was a flight director on a carrier. Connolly was a leader. A failure politically, but a man of great personal dignity, and you know, went down and crashed in the traditional sense in Texas, but essentially paid off his debts and died probably by virtue of the Homestead Act in Texas. You know, he's still in the possession of some land, but little else. But he was a very unusual individual.
So he didn't have a advising team the way Kennedy did in the form of Volker, Walker, and...
he had subordinates.
Let me ask you at this time. You said you were involved in GDP forecasting and monitoring at the, of the Fed. There was a famous, I don't know what to call it, instance where in late 1970, after the Republicans had not done too well in the election. Unemployment rate was unacceptably high, and the council thought that they couldn't get it down to 4% by fall 1972 unless they had very strong GDP growth, and the McCracken Council thought that they needed 1065 as GDP for 1971 if they were going to make progress in getting the unemployment rate down. Arthur Laffer came up with the amount of money growth that would take.
Well, as I recall it, it was Laffer and David Ranson at OMB working for George Shultz came up with the model to, and it was crammed down the council's throat.
It was just a regression of GMP on money,
right.
St. Louis.
Pretty much, yeah. I don't recall. Maybe no lags. It was kind of strange. Laffer and Ranson returned when Shultz was secretary, and I don't know. It seems to me by the time all the GDP revisions were done, they thought that they'd been vindicated. Laffer's, well, I won't digress, and maybe we outstayed your time. Laffer's, well, I don't know if you know him, he's an extremely interesting individual. And, Ranson himself in his own right, up with Wainwright in Boston. Yeah, both very gifted, but by standards of the profession, you know, close to being charlatans at the time, or so many thought. But
Did in following the Fed, did you develop any opinions on the relationship between Arthur Burns and administration and the pressures? There was
That's one episode that I wish I did have formed opinions on. I'm aware of, I don't know if it's a conventional wisdom, but at least the allegation that Burns went political in 72, and I've heard it argued on both sides, and I would hope and prefer to believe that that he didn't, but I've, the case has been made, at least the a statistical case has been made that if not compelling, it certainly gets you to scratching your head. No, I didn't. I don't know what I knew at the time. I'm not sure that I know what I know at the present time.
Did the Camp David decision to close the gold window and impose wage and price controls, the surcharge, all that, changes in the tax law, did that come as a surprise to you, or did you see the international situation deteriorating in the spring, think something dramatic was
there? Yeah, we knew something was going to happen. We didn't know when it was going to happen or how dramatic it was going to be, and I doubt that I knew even at the time the detail. I don't remember. The United Kingdom, you know, wanted some gold put in a bid, if that's the term, I think on Thursday or Friday, and that was sort of, it's generally regarded as the precipitating event. I remember being in, as a good part of Treasury was, over that weekend, and each had his own little chore to do, and no, it was, certainly nothing came as a surprise, except the actual timing and some of the high-level salesmanship. That, I guess, is, I've read accounts of it that, I forget by whom, you know, published accounts of what transpired at Camp David. We stayed down here.
Did you become involved at all in the, you still weren't in, you were still in the domestic side at that time. Your impression on the international was that, you know, primarily the U.S. was just trying to negotiate the biggest appreciation it could with very reluctant allies?
Yeah, I suppose that's, yeah, that's probably, I could not phrase it any better. I had, when Volcker came back, I did dabble around the international area, and with Ralph Wood at the Fed, we did a sort of a tour of the European capitals. I think we then were exploring.
Is that Ralph Bryant or?
No, Wood. I knew Ralph Bryant well at the time, but another guy. We did a tour of the European capitals, primarily wider bands or crawling peg. That was the very late '60s, and we were finally thrashing around trying to figure out something that would meet the needs of the situation. And so I was not unaware of the pressures that existed, and then worked fairly closely with Volcker on just the question of devaluation and whether or not it would or could be effective, leaving to him the details as to how it might be implemented.
What can you tell me about George Shultz? I'm interested in him, and obviously I'll try to talk with if I can.
Certainly an able individual, a little more doctrinaire in the monetary area than I personally would have preferred in a Treasury secretary, but didn't do a lot of damage with it. And
he had very strong free market views. He'd been opposed to the wage and price controls, but his role was primarily as a consensus builder, as someone who could get people to a policy, and then he could moderate it in a direction that he considered desirable.
Well, it was certainly his that's the book on him. Wasn't clear to me that he had too much influence in the wage price thing. He's more along for the ride, I always thought.
Mm-hmm.
Herb Stein, I think, is more important figure in terms of the design.
Sure.
But sure, Schultz was an important player.
Mm-hmm. Simon, Schultz's right. successor.
I just touch.
Well, yes, but he didn't have a lot of experience in government. Through the end of the Ford
Solomon Brothers,
through the end of the Ford administration, the primary players on the economic scene would have been Burns and Greenspan, or was Simon?
In the areas that they more or less relinquished, you know, his energies are there for a time, and sort of vied with Kissinger, so who knew the most or the least about international economic matters. activist, but certainly not, I don't know what his own assessment would be, but certainly not in the same league with Burns or Greenspan on economic or financial matters.
Mm-hmm.
An activist.
Okay. I'm kind of rushing through this because I don't want to overdo your goodwill. I'm loving your descriptions of people. I think it's wonderful because, you know,
I understand.
Contain that. Did you notice a big change with the Blumenthal Treasury? Did it? Their Council of Economic Advisors, Charlie Schultz, they were very much Keynesian, went back to the output gaps, the kind of sorts
right.
of ways of looking at things in the middle 60s. Did you did it seem like a change after Schultz and Simon, very free market people?
Right. And Blumenthal, something of a disappointment, obviously didn't last, you know, lasted about half the term. Key player here was Dan Brill, who had been at the Fed in the 1960s and then returned to Treasury. So
I'm interested in that comment. Obviously,
yeah.
I can't talk to him since
sure.
he's dead.
Right.
I would have loved to have talked to him. He was the one
yes.
who, as much as anyone, was responsible for what you mentioned earlier, the with the passage of the tax surcharge in June 1968,
right.
Would have been the Olken Council then, was
right.
sure there was going to be a recession.
Right.
Of course, it was an election year, and
yep.
The Fed lowered interest rates to stimulate housing, and
right.
inflation really took off.
It was a quadriad exercise.
And Brill, as much as anyone, was responsible for that exercise and left
right.
of it.
Yes.
But when he came back to the Treasury, somebody told me he was,
yes.
and he wasn't as he wasn't. He wasn't an academic.
No.
He was kind of self-trained in economics, but he was. I can't talk to him, and someone just said that
sure.
when he came back, he was much more conservative, much less Keynesian. Why do you say he was a major player?
Because he, particularly after Blumenthal left, Bill was, I guess you'd say he was a hawk by current terminology,
mm-hmm.
a belief in the necessity of quite a bit more restraint than was being applied. The council had a predilection then for all sorts of tips or wage price programs mm-hmm. and almost any kind of effort you might want to
yes.
cite, and none of which, in retrospect, with the wisdom of hindsight, you know, they were, if they didn't made no negative contribution, we were lucky. The thing, you know, was just away from us, and two oil price shocks and a Federal Reserve, which did not cover itself with glory by any means throughout the entire period.
Mm-hmm. So you said earlier you thought that Schultz was a little too doctrinaire, monetarist, but you were, sounds like you yourself
Bert were... Schultz,
that's what I meant.
Yeah, sure.
You yourself were becoming more concerned
about... Oh, the problems in that, they began with the Carter administration.
Mm-hmm.
Coming in with the proposal for a $50 rebate or something, and but it's easy to be critical.
Yeah.
Went fairly well, I would say, during the first 2 years. A little too much stimulus, but, you know, maybe one can be forgiven from skating a little close to the edge, but from then on, it was just a rolling disaster.
I have a lot of G. William Miller stories when he was chairman.
I'm in a different light.
I've heard very little about him at Treasury. Questions did you have of him as Secretary?
Generally speaking, favorable, although I do have heard not the wealth of anecdotes that you have, but I knew Steve Axelrod well, and he was a very unfortunate choice for the Fed, to put it mildly. He did much better here. He's an interesting individual, very strong person, deceptively so. I know he stood down here in the cash room, Textron scandal and bribery abroad, and faced down the wolf pack of Washington reporters with considerable aplomb and dignity. And I had quite a bit of respect for Miller. He was in a very difficult situation, and I didn't think he did that. I've known worse secretaries here. I would put Blumenthal in that category.
Blumenthal was a liberal, but he didn't, as you said, he was attracted to lots of different schemes. He was not educated as an economist, so he didn't have a...
Blumenthal?
Yeah.
Well, he was a Princeton PhD, but no, I guess you'd say not educated as an economist in the strict macroeconomic sense of the term, and a little too intellectual and precious for my taste, and really I didn't feel ever came to grips with the realities of the situation here.
He was not a forceful personality within the administration.
Quite the contrary. That's right. Why I mentioned Brill, because Brill did establish a good personal association with Blumenthal, and Brill was tough and strong and had the qualities which I felt Blumenthal lacked.
Who were the advisors within the Carter administration, or was it just Jimmy Carter? Jimmy Carter.
Unemployment. Who do we have at the council? Let's see, don't we have Charlie Schultz and Lyle Gramley?
Yes.
And then others
old.
Back. I don't remember, awfully hazy on names and details.
Yeah.
And the, of course, you can't imagine in some ways a stronger personality than Lyle, but I think through no fault of their own, certainly the council had no more than advisory status. But the thing just got away badly.
Yeah.
Chris Bosworth is in there somewhere. Was he at Council of Wage Stability?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, he did a lot of mischief there. Not really, I mean. And, you can see a person is able and well-intentioned, and I guess there's such a thing as doing the wrong thing. But, and believing it to be the right thing. The one episode, isn't it, in our experience, when we got close to open inflation, but we got way up in the double digits in quite an alarming way, and a 21.5% prime rate, a 15.5% treasury bill rate, so I guess something went wrong.
Yes, that's a fair assessment. Okay, let me finish up.
All right, sure.
And, I know you're... I know you're working.
It's all right. I recognize it to be a serious enterprise on your part.
I'm loving the conversation.
there might be a few phone calls pile up, but the foreign government, you know, they can wait.
The Treasury must have been an interesting place under the Reagan.
Fascinating.
Considerably.
In some ways, more interesting, I felt, than at any other period.
I mean, given that Reagan a latitude, I mean,
right.
The Treasury was very important in the
right.
in the Reagan administration.
Well, and also it was such a collection of diverse views, you know, the
mm-hmm.
supply side, and Burl Sprinkle as a representative monetarism, and we had sort of encapsulated here all the diverse, or many of the diverse strands of the Reagan Revolution.
Did you personally get along philosophically with these people? I mean, as MIT PhD, you'd come from a different sort of background, or did it seem kind of a wild place to you?
I had been here long enough by that time that differences of philosophy meant nothing to me. It was just very interesting to see and to some degree to interact with people that were. Well, I had the benefit of, I guess it was the benefit of an MIT education. I suppose because of the unique circumstance in which I happened to be, I felt the deficiencies of the Keynesian approach to the extent that I welcomed some kind of change, although not the sort of mindless experimentation that transpired during some of the period. Go ahead.
Were you still involved in the GDP forecasting and
yeah,
monitoring
right.
the Fed? So
it became, well, almost ceremonial during some parts of the period.
And there was a very famous forecast in 1981, I guess.
Right.
Were you involved in that at all or anything?
That period is well captured in Craig Roberts' Harvard University Press book, The Supply Side Revolution.
Okay, I've not read that.
Well, worth looking at.
Okay. Hmm. You mentioned you were a good friend with Charles Walker. He's somebody I should talk to.
Right.
Would you have a phone number for him or a?
I don't. I think my secretary would have.
What about Murray Wheaton?
Not sure she's still around. Well, Murray, of course, yes, a very old and good friend. I haven't seen him in longer, and I'd like to.
I'd love to talk to both of them, but I don't have phone numbers for either one. So, I could call your secretary. And...
Yeah, I guess we lost there. I was trying to get my secretary, but. She may have